Hi all. Welcome to the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood and our evening with Debbie Irving, nationally known speaker and author of Waking Up White. I'm Carolyn Musser, who along with Carol Oscalzo co-chairs our congregation's Racial Justice Committee, the sponsor of this event. And we are pleased to have all of you, people of all colors, tonight. A word about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood. We've been here at this spot for over 100 years as a member congregation of Unitarian Universalism, a liberal religion with no creed. We do have a covenant of seven principles which we work to affirm and promote in our lives. The first is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And the second is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. These are the bedrock underpinning of events such as this one tonight. There's literature about Unitarian Universalism over in the kiosk. We work to achieve an environment at our events where all who come feel comfortable asking your questions and expressing your opinions and beliefs. In turn, we also expect that all will be heard respectfully. A housekeeping item: bathrooms are out the door to your right and down the hall, as well as downstairs. You're invited to get food and drink during the evening. The Racial Justice Committee was spurred 2 years ago to its current focus as a result of the well-known series of killings of black men by white police officers and by the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement. We spent a year offering book discussions, documentaries, and speakers leading up to a congregational vote in spring 2015 to hang the Black Lives Matter banner that you may have seen on the front of our building. Another important outcome of this effort has been to see ways we can act as allies to people of color in their efforts to affect the structural racism embedded in our culture. An unexpected important focus, though, has come from reading and hearing black leaders say, in effect, "That's all fine and appreciated, but what white people really need to do is be working within their own culture." Reading Waking Up White was a step on that road here. Debbie Irving has been a teacher, a community organizer, and now author. Debbie will tell us a lot about her own journey. As one press release puts it, Irving uses her own life to explore the everyday systemic racism that goes largely unnoticed yet perpetuates long-held racialized belief systems. She unpacks her own long-held beliefs about colorblindness, being a good person, and wanting to help people of color. She reveals how each of these well-intentioned mindsets actually perpetuated her ill-conceived ideas about race. Her book, Waking Up White, was published in 2014 to excellent reviews, and there are copies on sale in the back. She has led many workshops since then at colleges and universities in religious and secular settings. Locally, her book was chosen by the Glen Rock Superintendent of Schools as one of the two books for district-wide focus this school year, and Debbie spoke in Glen Rock about a month ago. We are lucky to have her with us tonight.
Thank you, Carolyn. Now, first, let's make sure everybody can hear me. Is this sounding okay? I'll try to be, I've got this mic here. I just want to make sure. All right. So everyone's comfortable. This is where we want to be able to see the screen, so hopefully everyone can see that. I want to thank Ridgewood for having me. You know, it's a real step of courage in a predominantly, almost exclusively perhaps, white community
to take a stand and put up a Black Lives Matter flag, or to have Debbie Irving come in. And it's a real show of support for the organization when people show up. So thank you all for supporting not only my message, but this organization. And, you know, there was something I just wanted to bring to everyone's attention. I don't know if anyone read something in the paper. My press release got really mangled in a reporting here. And it said that what I do is I teach people of color about white privilege, which is just not what I do. Because I think people of color already know about white privilege. So I also heard that cry from people of color that white people need to do work in their own communities, and that's why I wrote this book, and that's who I'm here for. And for any people of color in the room, I think it's wonderful for people of color to bear witness to white people doing their work and waking up, but there's certainly no expectation that I'm here to teach any people of color or the people of color in this room to teach the white people in the room. So, just to clarify that. So as you can see, tonight's presentation is called I'm a Good Person, Isn't That Enough? But actually the tone is supposed to go like this. I'm a good person, isn't that enough? And the reason it has that tone on it is because that's the tone that ran in my head for years. So for anyone who doesn't know my story, I grew up in a white suburb, which you're gonna hear more about, a lot like Ridgewood. And I then ended up in arts and education on diversity committees for 25 years. And I really didn't understand whiteness, white supremacy, white privilege. And it turns out I really didn't understand what racism was. And I kept getting this sense in those diversity committee meetings, which were racially mixed, there was this elephant in the room feeling, there was this tension, and sometimes I didn't feel as appreciated as I wanted to. And in my head would run this language like, oh, you know, I don't have to be here. I would never say this out loud. But in my head, the script was something like, I don't have to be here. You know, I chose to be here, but I'm a good person. What more do you want from me? Isn't that enough? And I really hadn't given much thought to that tape in my head until the book came out. I go to book talks, and at the end of almost every book for the first 2 months, one would come up to me, invariably a white person, say, you know, I'm a good person. And I think that's really what we just need to be, because we're all human. You know, if we cut, we're all bleed red inside. I think we should all be colorblind and just love each other human to human. That's just what we need to do, don't you think? And I thought, dang, no. That's exactly what we can't do, and that's what kept me stuck for 25 years. And so that's why I've chosen this name. So let's really dig into this question, white friends. I'm a good person, isn't that enough? I'm a good clicker, isn't that enough? What's not happening? No, I have my own little clicker there. There we go. There we have our answer. Nope. It's not enough. So if you're here for the short version of the talk, this is where you leave. But hopefully you're going to stick around and dig in with me. Wait, why? What are you talking about, Debbie Irving? Why isn't being a good person enough? What more could you possibly want? Well, we're going to have to get used to this. Well, first of all, what's good? And who gets to decide what's good? So good is actually a pretty subjective term. We might be talking about good grammar, good manners, good dress, good way of writing an essay, but it's subjective. Good, what's right, what's beautiful? And so if you have one version of good, and I have another version of good, how are we gonna navigate that? And if you're my boss, we'll be going with your version. So the second you take something subjective and you add power to it, the person or the group with power, they're the ones who get to dictate, to use a pretty strong word, what is right in this situation? What is beautiful? What are the beauty norms? What is good? So I might have thought I was being a good person, but it turns out I wasn't having a good impact on a lot of people around me, and I didn't understand that. So how could we have different ideas about a word as simple as good? Well, we all walk around every day with our own belief systems. You're gonna find out in this talk that I'm a really happy Googler, enthusiastic Googler. I Googled belief system and this image came up, and I love it because it really speaks to the closed circuit loopness belief system is. And when I say that, what I mean is we will use what's already in our belief system to make meaning of the world around us, events, conversations, things people say. So what if my belief system is full of errors, omissions, myths? it's setting me up to misinterpret the world around me. Peggy McIntosh, a name some of you may know, she's a white racial justice educator. She talks about our belief systems are like our hard drives. And your hard drive is laid down by the time you're 5 to 10 years old. And you're stuck with it the rest of your life. You never get to go back and have another childhood. You never get to build another hard drive. So we're kind of stuck with what gets in there early because we're going on and we're basically collecting information in support of those early beliefs. She says the best we can do as adults is write and rewrite software that helps us make meaning of the hard drive, overwrite it, and reinterpret. So I just want to also say, as I'm thinking of my friend Tiffany Taylor Smith, my colleague and friend, Tiffany Taylor Smith is in the back. She is a cultural competency educator. Tiffany and I. Tiffany and I did an all-day workshop at Newark Academy today, and Tiffany, you also had a really great, it was tapes. Yeah, cultural tapes in our head, and we maybe have to listen to them carefully and say, where do I need to rewind and erase that and put a new tape in place? So a really similar idea. So what I'm going to be talking about tonight is my belief system. And I'm going to be speaking about, what I learned, how I learned it, who I learned it from, and then how I used it as I got older to misinterpret the world around me. So I have to, if I'm looking at my belief system, I've got to go back to my childhood. That's why there's a childhood picture on the front of my book, because all of our belief systems start getting built at such a young age. And as I tell my racial autobiography, I'm using the word racial because I'm going to be telling my story through a racial lens. I could be telling it through a gender lens, or a religious lens, or a class lens, or a sexual orientation lens, or a ability lens, but I'm going to be telling it through a racial lens. So as I tell my story of being white, my racial identity, in America, what will happen is that my experience of race is very much influenced by all those other things. So class influences it, religion, the era I grew up in, all those things are influencing. So no two people's story of being white will be exactly the same. So I'm not expecting people to say, you just told a story about being white that's nothing like mine. Well, that's not the point. The point is I'm demonstrating, modeling what it's like to tell a racial autobiography so that you can think about your own. So here I am, I'm innocent, I have no idea what's coming down the pike. I'm in Winchester, Massachusetts, which looks a little like Ridgewood. I was driving down the street saying, this Sheffield, this is this street, this is that street. So if you had said to me pre-wake up, which was only 9 years ago, I would have, and you had said to me, that's Winchester, that's where you grew up, whoa, I look at that picture and all I see is racism. I would have said to you, and I wouldn't have said it, I would have quietly thought it, because you don't talk about racism. I would have said in my head, A, you're crazy to say that, and B, it's comments like that that are the problem. You're just stirring the pot. Why would you say something like that? And I'll tell you now, I look at this picture and that is all I see. It's the first thing I see. So if you don't already know what I'm talking about, and I'm guessing most of you don't, when we come back to this image in 30 minutes, I hope you're going to see it with a different mindset. So I called Winchester my white bubble because it was exclusively white. It turns out there were some families of color living in town, but I don't have a memory or I never crossed paths. I'm not sure which. So for me, it was a white, very white experience, a white bubble. And this is what it looked like inside Winchester in the 1960s. So era is also very important. I was born in 1960s. Anyone know who this artist is? In unison, right? Norman Rockwell. So Norman Rockwell was a white illustrator who was charged with depicting the all-American life. And his illustrations were in the Saturday Evening Post, which was a widely consumed by white people magazine in the 1950s and 60s and maybe into the 70s. And it was also, these images were at the dentist office and at the post office. This was all American, and how convenient for me that what I was being told was all American looked exactly like my life. I didn't understand that that was not true for everybody. So what sociologists and people who study brain science would say is happening to me in my childhood, and I have no idea this is happening, is whiteness is being normalized. And by that, I mean, I'm not turning to my parents and saying, come on, Mom, Dad, where is everybody? This is so creepy. Why is everybody white? Your friends, my friends, classmates, the postman, the doctors, the nurses, the pharmacists, like everybody's white. What is going on? I don't think to ask that question because this is so normal. I'm just a little kid. So whiteness is being normalized. Now, in the 1960s, I did have access to the outside world. This is what it looked like in my era. So whiteness is continuing to be normalized. We're talking about a belief system. So I'm being exposed again and again to very similar images, both in my house, out of my house, now from the TV. So whiteness is continuing to be normalized. There's a lot else being normalized here. What else do you see? Patriarchy. Okay, so, and you know, if it says father knows best, there's an unspoken implication. Mother doesn't know best. Kids don't know best. So we've got patriarchy. We've got sexism. Anything else you see in there being normalized? Happiness. Okay, let's take happiness. Some people think that's funny. But if there's a real value placed on happiness, which there was in my household, when we got angry or sad, we were sent to our room and we were told not to come out till we could be in, we make ourselves right, basically. Right? I'm not the only one. Look at all these nodding heads. So if the value is on happiness, what does that say about people who are sad or angry? Broken. And I felt so ashamed of myself for the anger that I had to stuff down, and I learned basically not to really even feel. And I was taught with explicit language that people who complained were of poor character or poor rearing. And so in my childhood, when I was 8 or 9, the Vietnam War was going on, and there were protests going on, and I immediately discredited protesters. Because protesters, in my imagination, in my belief system, were people who were complaining, who'd been poorly reared. They're ne'er-do-wells, had nothing better to do with their time. So I couldn't even hear the message. So that's part of what happened to me in my socialization. Yeah, that's what happiness did to me. What else do we see being normalized in this one picture? The nuclear family. One mom, one dad. So we got heterosexuality, two parents. What about those teeth? They've had dentistry, maybe some orthodonture, so there are class implications here. So this is what all American looks like. There's a lot of pressure to fit into a picture that looks like this. Did I get all the ones I wanted to get? I think the 1960s was a huge time for the appliance boom. And that was in part due to post-World War II technology that came out of the military industry. So, yeah, so appliances and telephones, I think, were common in middle-class homes. Oh, interesting. So the next generation of men is all lined up. Interesting. Yeah, so amazing. No one's telling me, because we're not talking about a lot of stuff. It's amazing what I was learning from just this, you know, an image like this, a TV show like this. Okay, and it wasn't just in my neighborhood or on my TV shows. It seemed to me that white men father knew best forever, which in my childhood imagination, you know, how much further back was there than the first president, George Washington? So some people say, wait a minute, where's President Barack Obama? We've had a black president. And now we could add Donald Trump. But, you know, let's say both of those men are there. Let's say both of those men are there. Can we still say there's something of a pattern? And no one is unpacking for me why it's always, there's so many different types of human beings in the world and even on this continent. Why is it only this kind of a person who seems to be ascending to positions of leadership? You know, in my childhood, we had taboo topics. There were things that we clearly didn't talk about. We had an explicit line that was this: in polite company, never discuss politics or religion. There are also, sometimes people will say we were taught not to talk about money, we were taught not to talk about sex, we were certainly taught not to talk about race. And by the way, you couldn't even begin, I would never have begun to understand race and racism, and I didn't until it was put in the context of politics and religion, which are foundational to its construction. So avoid politics, religion. Man, you're avoiding a lot of stuff just with those two. And by the way, all it takes to teach a young child that something is taboo is for a kid to ask a simple, curious question, and the parent to look or a grown-up to look uncomfortable, or to say, shh, or to come up with an answer that's scary. So that's all. It doesn't take much to have a child learn, I am never going to ask that question again. And there goes childhood curiosity, one of the greatest gifts that we are born with. Meanwhile, amidst this incredible information vacuum, I'm being hammered all the time with images about this level playing field. America is a level playing field. Did anyone else get exposed to this idea? So the fancy word is meritocracy. People in the United States of America, which is a meritocracy, make it or not based on their own merit, their own hard work. So whether or not you bought into the idea, did I get exposed to this idea? It wasn't just me. So we have a lot of rhetoric that I was hearing that painted this picture for me. America is the land of opportunity, and people come here from all over the world so they can attain the American dream. And what do you do? What do you have to do to get the American dream? Work hard, and if the going gets tough, you even have bootstraps. So to me, this is post-World War II Germany. My understanding and my personal experience in my white bubble is that families are coming here from all over the world. It's a safe harbor. It is the only country in the world where anybody can come in a couple generations, reach the American dream. And so I'm surrounded by stories about my great-grandparents came here from Italy, Ireland, Poland, Russia, with 2 cents in their pocket. They didn't speak a word of English. They were treated like dirt, and look at us now. And so in my mind, this was completely true. I had zero examples of people who weren't able in a couple of generations to reach the American dream. And you think about, and so by the way, ideas aren't just like these flat two-dimensional ideas. A lot of times the ideas that go in our belief system are attached to an emotion. And attached to that for me was unbelievable pride and sense of safety and security. So this became a part of my identity. I live in the best country in the world. I am safe. This is my place. And you think about our documents, our foundational documents, life, liberty, justice for who? All. Public school kids, hand over heart, every morning, one nation under God and indivisible. Oh, what glorious ideas. Sea to shining sea, sweet land of liberty. Yay, I am so down for this experience. I love it, and nothing is contradicting it. Now, some people say, well, Debbie, I'm glad you're waking up. Your story's really neat. That's great for you. But actually, my white life was nothing like yours, or maybe I'm not even white. My life was nothing like yours. I didn't get any of those messages because I'm younger than you, older than you, diverse neighborhood, different part of the country. And I would challenge everyone to think, aren't we all exposed every day to ideas that some people in this country have more value than others? And what do we do with all these messages that we're getting? Are we just quietly storing them in our amygdala, as Tiffany spoke about today? Or are we unpacking them? So I can tell you consciously, I'm a racial justice educator. This is the world I want to create. Yay. But I have to be really honest with myself that I can tell you this is my we the people, but I still have a we the people that looks more like this in my imagination. This is who leads. This is who's fit to lead. So you can say to me even today, even after all the work I've done, Debbie, shut your eyes and picture an investment banker. Boom, this group comes up. And by the way, this is a Google search, board of directors. I have no idea who this group is. But don't you know this picture? Haven't you seen this? If I said board of directors, would something like this come up in your imagination? If I said investment bankers, would this come up? So for me, never, if you had said, think of a group of successful businessmen or investment bankers with this group of 50 black businessmen and bankers come up. Does anyone know who these 50 black, very successful businessmen and bankers are? So these gentlemen are from a period of our history called Black Wall Street, known as Black Wall Street, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So do you remember that thing about it takes a couple generations to reach the American dream? So we're a couple generations now. This is the early 1900s. We're a couple generations after emancipation. There's some retraction happening. There are black communities springing up all over urban areas in the United States. There'll be black neighborhoods. There'll be mom and pop stores, record stores, gas stations, some housing. A lot of those are gone. They were wiped out by the urban renewal program that started in the 1930s, dubbed the Negro Removal Program, because very specifically those neighborhoods were targeted to be the ones raised in order to build ramps onto the highways, which were to bring white people out to neighborhoods, which was part of a very intentional plan to segregate white people from everybody else. But you couldn't do that in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because this was no one-block situation. This was a 36-block situation. This was considered one of the most affluent neighborhoods in all of the United States. 600 businesses, 21 churches, 21 restaurants, 30 grocery stores, 2 movie theaters, 6 private airplanes, 1 hospital, 1 bank, and its own school system. The resource this community tapped into to build its wealth was the oil industry in Oklahoma. And, you know, I find it interesting. I was a history major. I never heard about Black Wall Street. I was researching this book. This story is not in my book because I discovered this with an accidental Google search 2 years after my book came out, when I accidentally had Black and Wall Street in the same search window. And I thought it was a joke. I thought it was April Fool's or something. And what is this true? How could I not know? And I have an MBA, which means I sat in a classroom talking about Wall Street every day for a couple years, and no one ever said the word Black Wall Street. I never heard anything about this moment of business history. I didn't know it existed, and I did not know that it had been bombed into extinction in 1921. Until 9/11, this was considered the number one act of domestic terrorism on U.S. soil. 15,000 people, 15,000 black United States citizens were permanently displaced. Hundreds were killed, and it was, the KKK was involved, but so were a lot of everyday citizens in Tulsa. So there was firebombing, both from the air and the ground, of the buildings. As people came running out of the buildings, they were stabbed and shot by Tulsa, Oklahoma citizens. It lasted less than 48 hours, and over the course of 48 hours, the Tulsa police got involved in the torching and the mayhem, as did the National Guard. So why don't we know about this history? I would like to know about it. I would much rather know something tragic like this happened than try to sweep it under the rug, because I do believe that history unexamined will repeat itself. And there was something else I was going to say about this. I'm really spacing on it. This is 1921. It was... Oh, isn't that interesting? Yes, so it's called a riot. And a riot implies that it was more two-way. This was a full-on siege. And it's true that the black people living there did try to defend themselves. Who wouldn't? I found on Amazon a short fictionalized account. But here's the good news. John Legend, who, for anyone who doesn't know, is a contemporary musician, and a group of people are currently working on a TV series about Black Wall Street that's coming out in 2018. So this will not forever be hidden, but it's really taken getting black people who might be attached to this history personally into positions of privilege and power to be able to get this story out into the open. So it was shocking to me. The history is a history major I didn't learn. I did have that in there for another night, but it wasn't for this one. So we're not actually going to pause. If I don't understand the level of discrimination that has gone on in this country, I am a sitting duck for myth-making around some of our fiercest racial justice advocates. People who are fighting for that world I say I love, that level playing field where everyone's really life, liberty, and justice for all, that's what Dr. Martin Luther King was doing. But I was a sitting duck for the myth that he had a dream that one day people would be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. Yeah, he said that, but he said so much more. I didn't know about his whole body of work around the triple evils. I didn't know about his family's multi-generational affiliation with the intersection of Christianity and organizing for justice. I didn't know any of that. I couldn't appreciate it because I didn't understand what he was fighting against. I also was a sitting duck for the myth that Rosa Parks was an old lady who sat down on a bus one day. Not only did I buy that myth, but I turned around and as an elementary school teacher, I taught it to children. I taught it to my own children in my own house. For anyone here who doesn't know the real story about Rosa Parks, that day she sat down on a bus, that was one moment in a very long and sophisticated strategy to spark the boycott. I didn't know that. And why would I ask questions? Really? She was so lit. I'm not questioning it. Because I am just a sitting duck. I also, it would have been helpful for me as a young white girl to know that there were white people who stood up actively against racial injustice. Albert Einstein, amazing racial justice activist, and Eleanor Roosevelt, I think I understood that she was a strong woman and for strong women, but she also was a fierce racial justice advocate. When she was first lady, she often, when she was invited to state dinners and other important things, she said, I'll only go if my friend Mary can come with me. Well, Mary Bethune was a fierce black feminist and one of her good friends, and so that's how she leveraged her privilege to make sure that she wasn't missing that opportunity. That would have been helpful for me to know that people like that, people who didn't just roll over and comply, that they existed. I did know that black people existed, which is interesting, growing up in an all-white town. By the time I saw Gone with the Wind, at the age of 15 or 16, when you walk to the movie theater, I saw this four-hour movie at least twice, and what I find notable is that I didn't come home and say, there was a 17-year-old girl scolding her elder. The most unbelievable thing. So this somehow, in my imagination, in my belief system, it's already, I've normalized social roles around race so that it's perfectly acceptable. It doesn't even cause me pause that a 17-year-old girl is scolding her elder or that that elder is wearing that outfit. I've dug deep to think, what were some of my early exposures? And this is one surprising source I came across. Anyone here know the Babar book series? Very popular children's book series. I had all of the books. And you know when a little kid loves something, it's again, again, more, more. So I know I saw the pages that I'm about to show you hundreds of times with no one saying anything. Check this page out. So what's happening on this page, the elephants are Babar's cousins, so they would be the protagonists in this context. And what the language beneath is telling us is that the African cannibal savages have jumped out of the jungle to attack the elephants. So if this is one of my earliest exposures to human beings with darker skin than what I'm used to, and it's being presented with a narrative about savagery, cannibalism, again, I think, beliefs don't just get into our belief system without some feeling, and I think this must have sparked a little bit of fear for me. And I wonder the degree to which it set me up to go and watch the evening news. We're trying to adjust the lights? Yeah? Is that lighting okay? All right. Better. Okay, so the question is, did it set me up? Did images and attached to a narrative of Savage, did that set me up to watch the evening news and watch the black guy doing the perp walk and not say, what is going on with this pattern of black men in handcuffs being taken to police cars? What is this about? I'm not asking that because, you know, I've got ideas about maybe that fits. Maybe I'm actually a little relieved that somebody is putting those scary, dangerous people away and I can stay in my nice, safe country. I don't like to admit that, but I have to wonder if that isn't in there. And look at what's on the next page. Civilization. To me, civilization was only ever presented as a white European kind of a person. That was civilization. Look at this. We've got savage and civilized and savage and civilized. Wow, that is an old story in the American narrative. And white people who have dominated the culture and the narrative since the beginning of United States history have been the ones to decide who gets in cast in the role of savage and subhuman. And I think that many different ethnic groups have been put in that role through history. What I find notable about this particular moment in history is how many different ethnic and racial and religious groups are simultaneously in that role. This is another piece of my childhood socialization. This was part of my Saturday morning cartoon series. Cartoons, for anyone who wasn't growing up in the 60s or watching cartoons in the 60s, they are so racist, it's unbelievable. So this particular character is Joe Jitsu, who was part of the Dick Tracy show, which I loved. And Joe Jitsu was, I guess, apparently supposed to be from some Asian country, and he spoke in this horrific mockery of some unidentifiable Asian accent, which you know was voiced by some white guy in a sound booth, probably in California. And what bothers me so much about this image and the story that I'm telling is that I thought it was so funny, as did my siblings and my neighbors and my classmates, to do this with our eyes and mock that accent. And that passed for humor. That was funny. So also normalized is poking fun at people who are perceived as different and getting social brownie points for imitating them well. That's another piece of my socialization that set me up to go and otherize and do incredibly mean-spirited things. But I'm a good person. This is an image I Googled indigenous American. Maybe I did Maine. And this image came up. And I thought, whoa, I have seen that exact image. What in my little world in Winchester, how was I exposed to this image? The intersection of indigenous people and poverty. Well, my family had a cabin in southern Maine. We still have a cabin in southern Maine, and we'd go up there every summer, and we would go to the dump every Saturday morning, and I would see images like this on the long dirt road to the dump. And what we did at the dump, you know, part of the excitement for the kids, I'm one of five kids, is that the kids would gather up things around the house that were being thrown away, but maybe someone else could use. And so when we got to the dump, my parents would bring the garbage over to the garbage pile, and it was the kids' job to bring the stuff that maybe someone could use over to the perimeter of the dump. And when we drove away in this big old station wagon, the fun for the kids was to look out the back window and see the Indians come and take our stuff. And I felt so good about myself for being from the kind of family that would take time to give our secondhand stuff to people who apparently needed it. So this is a really deeply twisted story, and I'll tell you why it's so twisted. I already had information in my belief system that had I connected it, I would maybe have come to a different conclusion. Let me share what else was in my belief system. This is the state of Maine. See those red lines? Those delineate land grants that were given out in the late 1700s, early 1800s. My family got a land grant. That's where that cabin is. So my family's land grant was. So I'd spent my whole life saying, my family founded a town. We got free land, and we founded a town. And it never occurred to me that for my family to have moved in on that land grant, people had been displaced. And now I'm patting myself on the back for giving my kind of yucky stuff to descendants of people that my family pushed off? That feels pretty twisted to me. I can understand why, you know, at age 5 I didn't connect the dots, age 10, age 15, but I was a history major. And then I'm writing this book. It took 2 years. It was 4 years of research to write this book. I'm 2 years into that process. I go to the White Privilege Conference. I choose from the catalog a workshop called Free Land. And I'm halfway through this two-hour workshop, and they're talking about the Homestead Act. And there's a panel of indigenous people reporting on what their family's experience was when they'd been pushed off their land and treated violently because of the Homestead Act. When I said, whoa, that's my family story. I never thought about another family's impact by what my family's history is. So I can understand, you know, sometimes not connecting the dots, but I do think for me, at least, that this is in play. A reassuring lie is so much more popular than an inconvenient truth. Because this is really, this isn't just additive knowledge. This is really kind of taking apart stuff that I once believed and having to question it and examine it and take in some pretty painful truths, especially where there's a lot of pride involved and identity involved. So another piece of history that was a major wake-up for me has to do with World War II. My dad was in the Navy, so I saw pictures like this in my house and uncle's houses and other men. You couldn't grow up in the 1960s and not know World War II veterans, who were called GIs in that day. Saw pictures like this around. I loved this one. And I knew about the GI Bill because my dad and his buddies, they didn't really talk about World War II arena much, but they did talk about that GI Bill and how it was proof that America took care of its own. So for anyone who doesn't know, the GI Bill was a package of benefits for returning World War II veterans that offered small business loan, farm loan, free higher education, and a no money down, very low interest, government-backed mortgage. So I knew that my parents had bought their first home for $17,000 in Winchester on the GI Bill, and I knew my dad had gone to Harvard Law School for free on the GI Bill. I knew that. What I didn't know was that the 1.2 million black GIs who also fought in World War II were mostly unable to access any of those GI Bill benefits, even though it said nowhere in the GI Bill that it was a white-only bill. And hold everything. When I first heard this information, the first piece I had to process was there were 1.2 million black GIs in World War II? I didn't know that. I only ever saw white GIs in my movies and textbooks and in my novels about World War II, and there was a lot of it around. How did I not know that? I would go on through talks like this. People come up to me after and say, you know, there's also this piece of information. It's through talks like this that I've learned that there were also indigenous GIs and Latino GIs and Asian GIs who were American citizens who fought in World War II to defend the United States of America and came home and were discriminated against. We heard a story today, wasn't it today, about the gentleman who came home? He was a black man, soldier, who came home and was put on a bus, and the black soldiers were put on the bus after the German, it was the prisoners, the Nazi prisoners of war, were considered a higher class than the black returning soldiers. So what happened? Well, it didn't say anywhere it's a white-only bill. On the school front, here's what happened. There was a quota system at the time in the 1940s, meaning that colleges and universities had 2 Jewish spots, 2 black spots, 2 fill-in-the-blank spots. Those filled up right away. Whereas for a white man like my father, there was endless capacity for where he wanted to go study any kind of higher education, and it was free. I have also learned from communities like this that historically black colleges and universities did absorb some of the capacity for the black soldiers, but there was actually another complicating factor going on, Social Security. So when my father came home from World War II, he didn't have to worry about supporting his parents or my mom's parents, who were doing just fine with Social Security benefits, another government program, another racialized government program. How was Social Security racialized? Well, in its original iteration, it excluded domestic and agricultural workers who were disproportionately black and brown. So you start to see the multi-generational compounding of advantage and disadvantage that people may be experiencing along racial lines. And then what happened on the housing front? Well, the Federal Housing Authority, an arm of the United States government, invented the mortgage in the 1930s. It was part of this predetermined, very intentional idea to get white people out into the suburbs and have a big housing boom. And you know, before the mortgage, people had to buy your house outright. You imagine that today? Or maybe 50% down and a loan with your friendly local banker. But in the 1930s, the federal government introduces this idea of the mortgage, and they turn to private banks and say, you're going to be the ones to dole these loans out, and you're going to be the ones to have to assess the risk as you hand them to individuals to go buy property. So we're going to give you some guidelines, private banks, says the FHA. Here's what we want you to think about when you're assessing lending risk. Number one, the condition of a property. That makes sense to me. Who wants to make a loan into a building that's falling apart? Condition number two, written into United States government guidelines, the presence of even one or two non-white families can undermine real estate values. So banks all over the country lay out maps of their area and engage in a process known as redlining. So outlined in red are neighborhoods that are populated by black and brown people. Green would be a white-only neighborhood. And then we've got blue, which is still desirable. And we've got yellow, which is definitely declining. And you know what that means? The black folks are moving in. White flight. Blockbusting. Blockbusting is something I'm not going to go into, but it's worth researching. If you're a Googler like me, it's very easy. These maps are all over the country. And it may seem like a long time ago, but this footprint, this housing footprint that got laid down is pretty much still intact. There's a private school in Providence, Rhode Island that has a third grade curriculum, because everyone is always asking, how young can we teach and what age can we teach in recognition of this whole belief system thing? There's a private school named the Gordon School in Providence, Rhode Island that has a third grade curriculum around redlining. And they teach redlining, and then the students do an actual walking tour of Providence and are able to say, wow, look at the line on the map and look at where I am. This is still the same. So you think about this, how is public education paid for in this country? Property tax. Where do we think the property values, see if I can go back to, I mean, let's just take Seattle for an example. You know, where are the property values the highest? So the schools here are going to be very different than the schools here. But of course, I don't know any of this. I'm just a good person, and the playing field is level. So I get out of college, and I start working in arts and education after school programs, and I encounter a neighborhood that looks like this. What do you think my belief system tells me? Not working hard enough, aren't taking care of their property. It's not even their property. These are slum landlords. Maybe not very smart. Maybe don't care about education. So all of these negative stereotypes that have been stored in my... It's funny, I used to do this until Tiffany's piece on the amygdala today, and now I want to say this. All of these negative stereotypes stored, collected and stored for years in my belief system, come spewing forth, and that's how I explain what I see. And I was very comfortable saying, I was very proud that I was working in under-resourced neighborhoods, but never did I say, and I come from an over-resourced neighborhood called Winchester. To give you a sense of scale of the GI Bill, just the housing portion alone, $120 billion, and this is in 1940s dollars, $120 billion went from government coffers into the hands of private individuals through that housing program, and 98% of it went to white families like mine. So it's basically, it's, you know, economic castration. I just look at this and I can hear the giant sucking sound of wealth. So when I say you know, I look at this picture and I see racism. This is the public library. This is the town hall. These are public buildings. What do you think we have for public facilities here? None. Or some, you know, crappy little corner building that's falling apart. So the education is different. The transportation options are different. The food supply is different. The medical care is different. Did I say air quality? I said food quality. Virtually every aspect of what we need to survive and thrive in this country is heavily restricted here and on steroids here. Now, what's interesting, I feel very comfortable here, but I've had a couple people come up to me at the end of talks like this and say, you know what's interesting? I am so creeped out by that picture. That's where I grew up, and that's where I'm most comfortable. So I was looking at it like, oh, those poor people. And I was going in to help and fix, which wasn't what was wanted or needed, and certainly not by somebody who didn't know what the heck was going on. This is the way I came out of childhood. I was a good person. So some people, when I show that picture of that urban, the black and white picture of that urban area, they'll say, oh, I bet you were scared. I bet that's what your belief system told you. I wasn't scared, and I wasn't like those stupid bad people who are, you know, weighing down our country. The kind of reaction my belief system gave me, because there was such an attachment to being a good person, was an urge to help and fix. And I had no idea the history I was repeating. Does anyone know who this incredibly helpful white woman is? Manifest Destiny, American Progress, yeah. So there weren't branding firms and marketing companies back then, but if there were, this would be the image that went with Manifest Destiny. So Manifest Destiny was the language given to the prevailing attitude of the time that was white European-descended people on the U.S. continent were God's chosen people. And it was their Christian duty to spread their Christianity and their overall moral goodness westward to the Pacific Ocean. And it justified the Mexican-American War, in which a huge chunk of Mexico suddenly became the states of... Yes. And all of the Mexican people living there are suddenly United States citizens or on U.S. land. So think about the Mexican-American soldiers who fought in World War II, only to come back and not be able to access the GI Bill benefits. Wow. So it justified the Mexican-American War, and it justified the displacement of indigenous people all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And when I use the term displacement, it took someone in the audience once to come up to me and say, that's a pretty sanitized word, Debbie, for a really violent history. And it is. It's an incredibly violent history. And the piece of the violent history of westward expansion that I have the hardest time with, that hurts me the most, especially as an elementary school teacher, former elementary school teacher, is what happened to the children along the way. So as in any moment of a society's journey, their history, westward expansion brought up the conversation about the Indian problem. What are we going to do about the Indian problem? And there were some suggestions that were pretty close to elimination. But there was a good white man who raised his hand, Richard Pratt from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and he said, no, I have an idea. You know, all is not lost. If we can get them young enough, I think we can wipe out that Indianness. We can kill the Indian in order to save the man. And so as Indian families were displaced and marched off of their land, the children were separated from their families. So just imagine that. We were all children once. Many of us may have children or grandchildren. Can you imagine being separated from all the grown-ups who you trust? So they were brought to Indian boarding schools. This is the first. This is Richard Pratt's in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, called the Carlisle Indian Boarding School. There would go on to be hundreds across the United States and Canada. And the idea of the boarding schools was to wipe out that Indianness. So when the kids arrived, they were considered, and they were their clothing was removed, their hair was cut, and were immediately cleaned in a kerosene and water solution. Scrubbed clean. Then they were given these little Anglo outfits and a Bible and a Christian name, and they were told not to speak until they could speak English. And I don't know about you, but if I were as terrified as I imagine these kids were, I think I would try desperately to figure out what's going on, and that would require speaking in my own language. Any word in your native tongue resulted in a mouth washed out with lye and often a sip to the tongue. Anyone know when the last boarding school, Indian boarding school, closed in the United States? In New Mexico is what I've heard, and in Canada even later. So this is not ancient history. You can Google this, and you can see YouTube videos of people who lived this, and it is as traumatic a history as you can imagine. And now I really do mean to have a pause button there. So I hope I've created a lot of impact. And one thing I've thought about is how when I was taught history, nobody ever asked me to feel. It was a purely intellectual exercise. So I'm laying down a lot of history, and I think it's important that we take a moment to feel. So I ask you just to check in with yourself. What are you feeling? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk from one side of the room to the other, and if you can characterize what you're feeling in one word, well, before we get into any more conversation, we're going to just take the pulse of the room. See what, if you could characterize it in one word, let's hear what people are feeling. If you say it, I'll repeat it so everyone can hear. Embarrassed. Sadness. Ignorant. Sad. Anger. Guilt, disappointment, shame, disgust, helpless, cheated, I think I heard disoriented, ashamed, angry, manipulated, brainwashed. I think that's my scarf doing that. Contradiction. So sometimes when I am in a more racially mixed room, I'll hear all these words, and I'll also hear someone say, finally, or relief. Because can you imagine if your family history is out of one of these discriminatory histories, and if you try to talk about it, people think you're stirring the pot? Or let's just move on, or be colorblind, or maybe just don't believe you. Totally misinformed. This was normal in the South. So this is right. So this is a really, so remember when I talked at the beginning? Right. But it's a this is a geographic difference. So as a New Englander, I was taught, so I had a couple relatives who had moved and married Southerners and were living in the South. So I was taught that the Southern people were the bad people. They were the bad racists, but not in New England. So what I have found is interesting is the amount of racial advantage that my family was taking advantage of all the time. And in fact, the entire United States economy is built on the fact that land was stolen, people were displaced, and enslaved Africans did the labor, and we had Chinese laborers who came over and built the railway, and they were treated like disposable machines, basically. So there's, you know, my family's wealth, I do have an upper class story, but my family's wealth, which was timber shipping, that's connected to the slave trade. Law, what were lawyers doing? They were protecting wealth that was created. So there's really no way in this country to separate ourselves from the slave narrative or the indigenous narrative. So I see a few questions, and I'm sorry. Is this me?
You think it's...
it's that.
I can also turn this into a handheld.
Little tiny handheld.
There we go. Okay, sorry about that, everyone. So I don't want to get too much into questions now because I'm going to actually, in a moment, you're all going to turn and get into circles and talk to each other, and then we will still have time for Q&A. But here's what I want to say about the level of emotion that was just experienced in this room. I think this is the trickiest thing about teaching to young children a truer history, because actually, kids are amazing. Young children, they will feel the injustice, and they won't get caught up in guilt or shame. They will feel it, they will understand that it's wrong, and they'll want to do better. They'll move through it. But it's the teachers, the adults, and the parents who have such a hard time managing some of the emotion around this. So it's very complicated to try to change this inherited pattern of we have about not talking about it. Some people say, well, this is ancient history. Why are you talking about this? Let's just be colorblind. Let's move forward. And then we have this whole generation coming up that's a lot more woke, to use the term that people are using, very much more socially conscious, especially people who come out of one of these discriminatory histories, who are saying, when are we going to learn? You keep doing this. Why are you surprised by what's going on in the country right now? It's always been going on. Wake up, people. So that's another gap that we have to contend with. And, you know, this is very much living history. It's all around us. Whose land are we on right now? Tiffany and I, a lot of the conferences we go to, there will be, the way the conference starts off every day is that somebody who's indigenous to the area will come in and give a blessing and say, you're standing on my family's land. I'd like you to know a little bit about our history, and I'm going to give you a blessing so that you can do this today on my land. I'm going to give my land to you for today. Imagine if every school day started off that way, or every Sunday at church. Some people say, Debbie Irving is coming to town. You know, she's a bleeding liberal from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Well, actually, it might surprise you. Tiffany, I don't even know you know this about me. I voted for both of the Bush boys. Because I'm an independent. I'm going to be picking people for the rest of my life. I'm going to be voting based on individuals. I'm really not liberal or conservative necessarily. I want the right tool for the job and the right approach, the right strategy for the issue. But when you don't even know what the issue is, there's no solution that's going to be useful. And so the first place I believe we need to get to as a country is the truth. We need to be able to tell the truth, and we'll only get at that by hearing multiple versions of history. You know, and this is my belief system in action. So if I had seen this graph about the racial wealth gap and I had seen that the average white American had so much more than I'll compare it to the black on the other end of this spectrum, what would my belief system have told me? Working harder, better at managing money. You know, now I see, well, this is an inevitable outcome of 400 years of policies and practices and laws that diverted wealth and resources to white people at the expense of everybody else. This is also data. You know, data isn't just numbers. Everything we see, Father Knows Best is a TV show. We're getting information all the time. This is one of the best things that white people can do, is start to notice what's going on in your belief system. What little messages are coming up? How are you interpreting this? I get a pang of fear when I'm at the airport and I see this, which tells me that I have some work to do about understanding what Islam really is, because I seem to have been overloaded with messages about Islam being the equivalent of terrorism. So if you start listening to your belief system as opposed to being afraid of it or denying it, which is what I did for years, it's an incredible informant. So this is what I want. This is the we the people. I'm really for this, but if I want something I've never had, I have got to do something I've never done. And I can tell you that consciously I am for multicultural, pluralistic democracy, but unfortunately, I've got a lot of white supremacist nationalism White supremacy isn't KKK neo-Nazi. It's a philosophy that white people are superior. I cannot deny that that's what I was exposed to my entire childhood by really good, charitable people. So three quick things, and then we're going to have a conversation. Because this is the part where people say, tell me what to do. Okay, here are three to-dos. Learn and tell untold history. The best source for history is always people telling their own history. So if you want to know more about the indigenous experience, find people who it's in their family history. This is one of my favorite introductions to the other sides of history. We've got history that lives in our families, in our regions, in our sector. By sector, I mean faith, education, medicine, transportation, and institution to institution. The UU history. Today, Tiffany and I could have done some about the private school industry or our Newark Academy where we are. There is no sector or institution or family or region that doesn't have a racialized history. It's a great place. And the reason I give all these options is because if you're going to try to make yourself, study something that you're already interested in. If you're a foodie, there is an incredible racial story around the food in America. If you like sports, incredible racial stories around the way sports has been constructed in this country. So pick something that you're already passionate about so you'll stick to it. Two, be radically curious. We are all born curious. I had it slapped out of me in many ways. You know, a mother who went shh about a lot of things. Lovely mother. I loved her. But there were so many off-topic conversations that I learned just to stick to polite conversation. Also, anyone go to school where you were told to raise your hand with the right answer? And I was told, you know, no such thing as a stupid question. But of course, I knew there was, and I didn't want to ask it. So I started concentrating more on being the smart person with the answers instead of the curious one who was wondering and struggling maybe. So I really have to stop and ask myself again and again, am I right? Am I wrong? Like, how do I make meaning of this moment? I can't always rely on this. So I have to be curious even about my own belief system. Education is learning what you didn't even know you didn't know. This is now my life motto. The third thing is build courageous conversation skills. It is really hard for white people to engage in conversations about things that they were taught in their childhood were taboo topics. This is the number one here thing I hear from white people. I'm so afraid of saying the wrong thing. Yet, you know, conversation is the way human beings think together, so we have to find a way to talk about this. And the thing... That's learning how to not talk about it. The thing about it is uncomfortable. These conversations can be painful, and yet there's a real difference for me and a colleague or friend of color engaging in a cross-racial conversation, what we're worried about. I am worried about saying something stupid or wrong. It's only about my ego. For my friend or colleague of color, historically, what has been at stake for that person to speak his, her, their truth? It's been a matter of life. And, you know, getting hired, getting a promotion, and I hear this story all over the country about parents of color who go in to advocate for their child only to be labeled difficult, and then they lose all agency over that, their own child. And so the stakes are so much different. The histories are so much different. And I say that, when I realized that, And I even have a chapter called Getting Over Myself, because I realized you have got to get over yourself. You're worried about your face blushing and your heart beating fast. So I had to learn to trust that I would recover and that friendships and relationships could endure as long as I stayed engaged and owned my own ignorance and sort of made a commitment. I'm going to stay in this. I'm really in this with you. It was Tiffany today, the word ally we heard when Carolyn was introducing me tonight. Tiffany uses the word comrade, which I like a lot. I'm in this with you. I'm not here for you to help you. I am in this with you because the country I want is the same country you want. And this is about, you know, you really do have to get out of your comfort zone to learn. That's true for everybody, whether we're talking about learning math or learning to have a courageous conversation. We all do have to get a little uncomfortable, and yet it is true that we can all get tripped into fight or flight. It's for white people who I think have more work to do around growing comfort in these conversations. It's really important to have some ways to de-escalate when we get triggered. How am I going to contain myself so I don't lash out, so I don't get super defensive? So there's a lot of work to be done in white communities around that. And speaking of comfortable, I'm kind of the comfortable anti-racist for white people. You know, I'm an older lady, I wear pearls, I'm not very threatening. Can you imagine hearing some of the stuff I've been talking about from one of the people who lived it? That, for me, has been really uncomfortable. And so, you know, there are a lot of people who know a lot more than me, but it's interesting that I'm the one being called out to communities. I think it has to have something to do with the fact that I'm white, and it's more comfortable, and I'm more credible to people who might just be beginning to grapple with this. So I always say, you know, that's just a reality that we have to deal with. And when, as soon as you get over that, bring in a person of color. Look at, these are six of my colleagues, all of whom have PhDs in this subject, all of whom have lived aside of this experience that I couldn't possibly come close to talking about. So don't stop with me, which I know you won't. And there it is, paradigm shift.